Joining us in the studio today is Jim Molan, a retired Major General, and he had 40 years service across a broad range of command and staff appointments in operations, training, staff and military diplomacy. What a field you've been in, Jim.
It's certainly been wide, Helen, and that's the amazing thing about a military life. Those that stay long in the military life can be exposed to an awful lot. Most of our soldiers don't stay for more than 3 or 6 years. The kind of next generation may not get to 15 years, and a very small proportion who get close to the top or close to the top have the ability to experience the most amazing things. And I just tried to keep up over those 40 years, Helen.
We hear that aspect from most of the people that we speak with on Service Voices. And it always blows me away just what a diversity of interests they have and what a diversity of careers they've had in the military, whether it's Army, Navy or Air Force. What was your background before you joined up when you were still a young lad?
Well, I went straight from school. I was 17 in my first year in the Army. And really, this is the height of the Vietnam War. And I joined with the expectation that I would go and fight in Vietnam. Now, I made the classic error, I was too young really to go anywhere, but I made the classic error of going to Duntroon, which was a 4-year course, and that of course graduated me in December 1971. Those of us who were going to infantry were posted throughout that last year at Duntroon to battalions rotating through Vietnam, but by the time I graduated, the government had decided to end our commitment there. The last thing you want if you're going to win wars and prosecute wars successfully is reluctant soldiers. Soldiers must be controlled and must act in accordance with the laws of armed conflict, etc. But we were very disappointed that we didn't get the chance to go to Vietnam and to serve in Vietnam.
We'll get back to your time in the forces. You're currently acting as a corporate speaker, and your subject in there is leadership in challenging times. Can we just touch on that? How do you keep a whole room full of people interested in that subject?
Well, I must admit, I don't think I've had much trouble keeping people entertained for the simple reason that most Australians, and this is the reason I imagine for a community radio station like yourselves, to address these subjects, most people are not exposed in Australia at the moment to their own military. Their own military is so small and we're such an enormous country that most people don't know anyone in the military. And quite often, because of the fact that military life and wars are splashed across our movie screens and across our newspapers and media, they have a particular view. So when they meet someone who is prepared to talk about what the military does and how it does it and how we lead and what we do, then people seem to find it interesting. And if you can bring it back to what should be happening in civilian life, in corporate life or in government, then people see the value. Most of the time, Helen, I start off by saying that I'm not here to teach. All I'm here to do is to present a way of doing things using various conflicts I've been involved in as examples and let people say, well, you know, that's an interesting way of doing things. Maybe we can try this or try that.
I agree. There is an enormous amount of interest. And yet it tends to be not spoken about very much. So Service Voices has been extremely popular to bring those voices to radio. So Jim, getting back to leadership in challenging times, can we just chat about the challenging times?
I think at the moment the international situation is extraordinarily uncertain. Now, at any point of time, you can say that things are uncertain, that risks are great, and we need to take measures to manage the uncertainty. I think at the moment, for the last 75 years, and this is contentious, I don't think things have been as uncertain for Australia as they are at the moment. For most of that 75 years, we were the ally of the most powerful nation in the world. We came out of World War II as a part of the victorious forces. The American forces pretty well dominated the world. It was at least a bipolar power situation. After the Cold War, it became a unipower situation, and America did dominate the world for a period of time. But now things have changed, and they've changed quite dramatically, in my view, in relation to defence and security. And the Americans speak about defence and security in a particular way. They they say that the challenge that they face in these uncertain times comes from four countries and an ideology. And they speak of the four countries as being Russia, Iran, China, and North Korea, and the ideology as being Islamic extremism. And they've been speaking this way for many, many years. But not only, this is what makes the time more uncertain and why Australia should be rethinking its own defence and security from the bottom up, that not only have those that may be in competition with us for strategic influence been growing in power, but for various reasons, the American military is relatively less powerful than it has been for many, many years. And I write and speak about this quite often. I think that we need to realise this. In the past, Helen, we could have the silliest defence policies in the world and get away with it because we're the allies of the Americans. Now I think we have got to, and I wrote about this last week in a national newspaper, now we've got to be very, very seriously moving into self-reliance because the capability of our great and powerful friends to come to our aid is not as strong as it used to be.
Mm. How do you see the situation with our current training of reservists to be called upon to serve alongside full-time military forces in Australia? Do you think that that's serving us well?
Yeah, I think it's serving us very well, and I hear the service chiefs talking about it, and they're very positive about it. That's the kind of detail that only the service chiefs can get down into, only the military can get down into. And what governments have got to lay across the top of that is they've got to lay across the top of it the output of defence. You know, people say to me, oh, well, do you think we should have 12 submarines? And the answer to that, and you know, we're past that debate now, but when that debate was going, people would say in the media, do you think we should have 12 submarines? And the answer is, it depends what you want to do with them. What you imply in your question is the Army Reserve big enough and are we using it well enough? Well, it depends what your big picture is. And I look at every political party that we've got at the moment, and every one of them has a defence policy. Even the Greens have a defence policy. But it all consists of lists of ships and planes and tanks and people and dollars. And the people might be full-time, they might be part-time. The problem with that is, yes, we've got the best defence policy we've had since 1976, in my view, but the world has gone ahead a million times. And if we're just going to look at the things that I mentioned before, ships and planes and tanks and people and dollars, they're inputs to defence. The government's job is to concentrate on the output to defence, and the output to defence is winning the next war. And that requires the government, not us, the government, to state what they think the nature of the next war is, not to say who they think we're going to be fighting. That's contingency planning and that's all top secret type stuff. But the government has an obligation, if it's going to make its military expenditure defendable against other priorities that the nation has, it must be prepared to state what war it thinks it's going to fight.
Hmm. You have a background in service in conflicts.
I was awarded the Distinguished Service Cross for Command and Leadership in Action in Iraq, which is probably the thing that I would feel most proud about. Because for a soldier, that's the culmination of being a soldier, is to perform in action as you should. And the interesting thing is that I don't feel that my generation has faced the kind of challenges of the First World War, which we're celebrating 100 years ago, you know, for the last couple of years. I don't believe that my generation, that is, say, the post-Vietnam generation, with a few exceptions, particularly our special forces, have been involved in the kind of conflicts that the First World War, the Second World War, Korea and Vietnam represented. The intensity of those and the sacrifices that individuals made was of a different magnitude that I admire extraordinarily. That's not to say that the Iraq War and the Afghan War were not vicious and nasty and as bad as all wars. It's just that, with a few exceptions, our roles in them were not as great and we were not as upfront as we have been in past wars. So by playing a bit part in the Iraq War, I kind of was able to gain some kind of understanding of war in general.
Well, you must have understood a lot, Jim. You were also awarded the Legion of Merit by the United States government.
Yes, that was very generous of them, and their citation was very generous. And people look at the pictures of American generals or American soldiers with a chest full of medals, the irony is that most Australians don't realise that most American soldiers earned those medals. The generals that I was in Iraq with, this was their third or fourth serious war in their career. And many of them spent much longer in those wars and went on to other wars subsequent to it. In our society, we have a stereotypical view of the Americans that I think a lot of us got from our failures in Vietnam. And those failures in Vietnam, the fighting side of those failures are often wrong. Quite often, the failure in Vietnam can be put down more to the political side of prosecuting a war rather than to the fighting side of it, regardless of whether you consider the war was correct or not. But it was very good of the Americans to recognise my service there. In Iraq, I was what was called Chief of Operations, so it was an American job that I was doing. I replaced an American two-star general, and I was followed by an American two-star general, and I did that for a year in Iraq.
Now, you're also an Indonesian speaker. How did that come
about?
Well,
when I was a captain, which is a long, long time ago, in the 1970s, I had certain postings which I wasn't too enamoured of, and so I tried to get overseas. My first posting out of Duntroon was 3 years in Papua New Guinea, and I then came back to posting in Brisbane, and I was looking for greater opportunity and a bit of excitement, and one of the ways to do that was to get to the United Nations. So I applied for the United Nations, was told that I needed language training, but the only language training I could do was Indonesian, which wouldn't get me to the United Nations. So I did Indonesian, and it was incredible. I went to the Defence School of Languages down at Point Cook in Victoria. It was an extraordinary school. After about 6 or so weeks, we passed third-year university standard, and we just went on and on and on. And Indonesia is a comparatively simple language compared to, say, Chinese or tonal languages. And so at the end of it, we'd reached a fairly high standard. But I volunteered for that, did that, and then really didn't use it for many years. I didn't use it in being posted to Indonesia, but I maintained contacts within the Indonesian military because of it. So when they wanted an army attaché to go across and work in the embassy for 3 years, I got that job. It's a funny thing with languages. I found I was a better kind of operator of a language than a technical linguist. But by the time I'd finished my first 3 years in Indonesia, I thought I was fairly good at languages. I then came back to Australia and commanded a brigade in Australia. And then as a brigadier, I went back and did another 2 years. And it's a real privilege, Helen, to be allowed into the centre of a foreign military. And you don't question why you do things or whether you do them well or whether you do them badly if all you see is your own system. But as soon as you're exposed to other systems, and we in the military have a good exchange program to try and keep this up, but as soon as you're exposed to other systems, other militaries, you can say to yourself, well, that's why they do it. Is that good or is that bad? Is that better or is it worse? Can we learn something or could they learn something from us? So a fantastic experience. I had 5 years working out of the embassy in Jakarta during some incredible times. The fall of Suharto, the establishment of democracy, East Timor. It was like being on operations, I must admit.
Amazing. Now, during that period, you also became a helicopter pilot. Did you use that during your military service?
Oh, I certainly did. And someone who was a bit cynical about me said when I applied for helicopter training as a young officer, they said, well, I hope he's never posted to a fire station because he'll want to be a fireman. So I had a bit of a reputation of going from one to the other. But my basic trade was an infantryman. And as a commander of infantry units, you stay within the infantry stream for a little while, then you start commanding other arms within the military, so armour, artillery, engineers, and you become a combined arms commander, what they're called, and then you start branching out into the other services. So you then become a joint force commander, so you command elements from the Army, the Navy and the Air Force. And the air-mindedness, you know, we developed an extraordinary level of air-mindedness during and after the Second World War, certainly during Vietnam, but we really only set up our own Army Aviation Corps that operates helicopters during Vietnam, and it started to mature after Vietnam, and I was asked for a bit of excitement, so I also applied to go flying, and I did 6 months flying training with the Air Force at Point Cook, then up to Oki to do my helicopter conversion, then a couple of years of operational flying. As a combined arms commander, it gives you an understanding of capabilities that often you don't get if you're just an infantryman. You know, the broader your experience, the better commander you can be.
Your pro bono work includes 5 years as director of the St. James Ethics Centre, now the Ethics Centre, and an air power think tank. Talk about that.
Well, the Ethics Centre is something I look back on with a great degree of affection. It's an extraordinary organisation in the centre of Sydney. Its aim is to be non-judgmental, non-profit, giving advice on ethics. And ethics essentially is doing the right thing. And my interest in it was sparked, firstly, it was sparked by the fact that throughout my career, the Army has required that I pay great attention to what we call the laws of armed conflict, which is a way of standardising a humane approach to warfare. And this is based on many hundreds of years of Judeo-Christian ethical approach to war. It's been laid down in various charters in the United Nations and the predecessors to the United Nations, various religious texts. And I came back from Iraq, having been a senior commander in Iraq, a staff officer, chief of operations in Iraq, and a certain elements in our society wanted to take me to the International Criminal Court as a war criminal. Bizarre approach, to say the least. People who think because you go to war, you're a war criminal, are a strange breed unto themselves. And I wrote the book I wrote as a way of expressing my experience of all of this, of the full aspect of my experience of running a war in the latter part of the century. And I put all that together, and then a guy called Peter Joseph read the book. He was the chairman of the Ethics Centre, and he asked me to be a board member. And the executive director is someone called Simon Longstaff, that many of you will know as an ethicist, as a philosopher, as a man who has spent all his life studying philosophy and ethics, and who I think is probably someone with the most pronounced ideas and how to communicate them of anyone in the philosophical game. And it was fascinating. We often didn't agree, myself and members of the Ethics Centre, but the conversations were always good. I learned an awful lot, and I certainly hope they did. And even Simon has brought his ethical background into assisting various political parties, although he is non-political himself, as the organisation is. So it's a fascinating natural asset that this country has.
Talking about assisting and helping, your co-patron of a foundation commemorating the life of one of your bodyguards. Are you willing to talk about that?
Oh, yes. It relates to Sergeant Matthew Locke. When I was in Iraq, I had a 12-person bodyguard for the simple reason that if you are conducting operations, as we say, amongst the people, if you're a military force in the middle of a population, it is very easy to be attacked. And so if you want to move from A to B, if you want to go out and conduct a meeting or see what's going on or whatever, you can't just get in a single soft-skin vehicle and drive there. So any time I went there, and I'd go out almost every day, any time I went to a meeting or went to visit others or went to see operations, I had my own convoy of four armoured vehicles, and my bodyguard consisted of four Special Forces soldiers and American soldiers who would act as the majority of the bodyguard. But the bodyguard was under the command of an Australian Special Forces sergeant, SAS sergeant. And at one stage, I first met Matthew Locke when he was a member of my bodyguard. He was a trooper, a young Special Forces soldier. And these guys were mind-bogglingly good, as we know our Special Forces are good. The Americans accepted the authority of the Australian sergeant, regardless of what their ranks might have been. And Matthew was a part of my bodyguard for the time I was in Iraq. Then he did various deployments to Afghanistan, and he won a military cross in Afghanistan in one of his deployments. And in the second deployment, he was killed. And his family is rock solid in commemorating him. He was a fanatic for NRL, rugby league. And each year in February, Army plays a big commemorative rugby league game against the local rugby league team, and we all go up and we have a great time. And you know, once a year, we, his friends, remember him. His family and his close colleagues would remember him much more often. But Matt was your typical bushy Aussie. You know, his father was a woodcutter. He lived in northern New South Wales. He joined the Army Reserve and the Regular Army, found his niche in life in the Regular Army, was brilliantly good at it, a brilliant soldier. and something that I think we do very well. And we owe these people, particularly those who are injured, mentally or physically, and we owe the family of those who are killed an awful lot.
We certainly do. You're a volunteer firefighter with the ACT Rural Fire Service.
I still am, nominally. Unfortunately, I've been through a very interesting period with a knee and a hip, Helen, which has prevented me doing it. I'm getting to a stage where I've got to admit that I'm getting old. It's a hard thing to admit. So I've been a no-show for almost a year at the Geysers Creek Rural Fire Service, which is in the ACT. I live just across the border in New South Wales. There's a big ACT RFS shared just across the highway from me. These guys are great guys. Because I was a passionate pilot and passionate about flying, and I flew helicopters in all my leaves, annual leave from the Army, I'd go away and, to my wife's joy, I would go away and fly helicopters in firefighting or something like that. So I had experience in aerial firefighting as a pilot. And I stopped that about 5 or 6 years ago. Another reason was my coordination and judgment as a pilot wasn't getting any better, so I decided I'd get out before I killed myself or someone else. What you miss as you get to be a senior officer and as you leave the military is the camaraderie of a group of Aussies. And you don't find a better group of people than in the Rural Fire Service.
Yeah.
Everyone's different and they do a mighty job. And it's not an easy job. The firefighting part's the exciting part of it. The hard part is the training, the qualifications, the putting together of the skills, the maintaining the equipment over the long period of time, and then the panic of fighting fires during the hot season.
Mm.
And, of course, these guys do it very well. So I am a member of the RFS. I am not very current at the moment.
Right.
Not current at all, but I still pay my funds, Helen.
But in 2010, you were called on as an expert witness on the subject of crisis management for the 2009 Victorian Bushfires Royal Commission. Now, that was a nasty incident, wasn't it, that fire?
That was an awful fire. And I really made a lot of contacts. I was asked by the lawyer assisting the tribunal to speak about crisis management. And as chief, I came back from Iraq a couple of years before that. And what I did in the military fundamentally was run operations. So operations are all about planning for operations, then managing the crises that come through. I wrote a brief for the tribunal on what I considered and what the military considers to be aspects of crisis management. That went ballistic over the internet. Many, many people saw it. I gave evidence for a couple of hours, and that was a good experience. And on the basis of that, I was asked to be a director of the National Aerial Firefighting Centre, which is, in my view, one of the best bodies which covers all the jurisdictions, federal and all the states. And it consists of the heads of the various rural fire services throughout Australia in each state, plus one non-executive type director, one non-professional director, which was me. And I was there for a couple of years. They used to be given about $15 million by the feds, and they'd then add more into it from the states. And they would then hire as a single body all the aircraft that were leased throughout Australia and the ones that came into Australia, such as the big orange sky crane. I think they were a model which you could use really well. In the past, people used to compete. If a company in Victoria was hiring out aeroplanes, Queensland might be competing against New South Wales for that. Now, that doesn't achieve anything. That just pushes the price up and everyone loses. But with one leasing body for the whole world, across the whole world for Australia, it was done very, very well. They allocate them from one crisis area to another, and I think they're a tremendous organisation, National Aerial Firefighting Centre.
Sounds great. Do you think that our technology has advanced enough in regard to firefighting these days?
I think it's quite extraordinary. I first became involved with them after I'd been to Iraq. In Iraq, I saw the most advanced technology which existed in the whole world at the time. Technology of knowing what was going on, where things were happening, the ability to react. And as chief of operations, a lot of it came back in centrally to me. And so I was interested to see where the firefighters were. The firefighters might have been one step behind us because they didn't have the vast amount of American money to throw at things like this. But since then, they have moved into this command and control, a real-time picture of a fire, the ability to look through the smoke, the ability to communicate with each and every vehicle on a fire ground. I think their technology is amazing. They've now gone for the big aeroplanes that we see. They bring them in from the US, big helicopters. The individuals, I just at the top, are very, very skilled. It was funny because I went down to my local rural fire service at Geysers Creek in the ACT. On the first big fire we deployed to, I must have had a smile on my face all day because it was exactly as we conducted military operations. These guys are professionals on a volunteer basis. And I think that it's a measure of any society, particularly advanced societies, as to how they manage natural disasters.
Jim, you've led an incredible life. Any regrets?
Not that I can think of, Helen. I wish my knee was better and my hip was better, but I've had an enormous privilege. And people say, you know, you've been very, very lucky. And I have. There's always an element of luck in this. If I had badly smashed my knee when I was a young officer, then I would have had to have left the infantry. If I'd been injured in any of the activities, then that would restrict me in what I was doing. But I sometimes say to myself, and I never offer my children advice because they wouldn't take it, but I say to myself that, yes, I've been lucky, but the harder I work, the more thoroughly I work, the more I prepare myself, the luckier I seem to get. There might be something in that.
And is that a word of advice that you'd pass on to young men and women considering your future?
I wouldn't be so presumptuous. I wouldn't be so presumptuous. But if they want it, they can have it.
Right. So, Jim, life's looking good for you at the moment?
It is. I'm edging my way into the Senate. I'm very surprised I'm there, and I'm setting up offices. But life is good. My children are all well. My wife is well. So the family's good, and you can't ask for much more than that.
Absolutely. Jim, thank you very much for chatting with Service Voices today. We really do appreciate it. I look forward to keeping an eye on your career as it progresses.
Thanks, Helen. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.